band manager, road manager, concert producer, stage manager, publicist, production manager for some of the most incredible bands. Some of my most favorite bands in the San Francisco Bay Area and outside, too. Steve, welcome. You are on the air, my friend.
Thank you for having me, Jay.
Absolutely. Your book is really exciting. I was thinking about interviewing you anyway, and then when you came out with your book, I go, that's it. I gotta get in touch with this guy.
I'm glad you did.
And I looked at it. I've been looking at it online and stuff because it's so easy to go. It's www.stevekiser.com, and it's an incredible book. It really, really is. It's so big that, you know, I was only able to like scroll through it, but I went to some of my favorite parts anyway.
Well, good. And by the way, it's Steve Kiser, KEYSER.com. And it's a free ebook. You can either read it online or you can download it onto your computer and read it at your leisure.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. So, man, this has been going. I met you. Let's start with that. I met you at Freddie Roulette's benefit down at the Great American Music Hall. About 5 years ago.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that was really a beautiful affair. It really was. But Freddie was really moved. And if people don't know, Freddie's home burned down, and it was a benefit to help him get back on his feet. And a lot of people showed up, I'm telling you. Boy, there's some great bands there that night.
That was in 2015.
Is that right? Yeah, so it was about 5-6 years ago. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so I ran into Terry Haggerty. I know Terry, but I got to see some just incredible artists that night. Anyway, that's a really nice venue down there. So anyway, we'll go back. You can start whenever you want. It starts with your life. You know, your as you grew up and everything. You know, you've had really an incredible life here, but as a booking agent, you just have an incredible resume, which we will go over it, and your book. But I've seen some of the people you've worked with. It's just incredible. The Dinosaurs with Robert Hunter. He's incredible, just incredible.
Yes.
Did you ever meet Mr. Hunter, Robert Hunter?
Oh, I was the manager for the Dinosaurs from the day they started in 1982.
Oh, okay.
And then they had various lineups, and they played for somewhere into the early 90s.
Yes.
The original band was Barry the Fish Melton from Country Joe and the Fish, mm-hmm. Peter Albin from Big Brother and the Holding Company on bass, the drummer Spencer Dryden from the Jefferson Airplane, John Cipollina, guitar player from Quicksilver Messenger Service. And then on their second or third gig, Robert Hunter came. Robert Hunter, of course, the lyricist from the Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
He came down to sit in with Dinosaurs and decided he had so much fun that he would join the band. Hunter stayed with the band until, I believe it was 1995, decided he wanted to move on and do some other things.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Merle Saunders came in to take Hunter's place. So, yeah, I knew Hunter very well.
Wonderful. Oh, I mean, he is my favorite. And I really believe, second to Bob Dylan, he is just a master songwriter. I mean, look at the stuff he's done.
Absolutely.
And even after Jerry passed away and the band broke up, he's worked with so many other people. Little mm-hmm. Feet, Zero, the band Zero, David Nelson, and the new Riders of the Purple Sage, he wrote for them. I mean, I love... I interviewed Papa Molly with the Seven Walkers. He did the Seven Walkers, and just Robert Hunter. His lyrics just have always touched me. They really have.
For sure.
I nearly have almost every single song that Robert Hunter has penned or co-penned, because I just love him so much. I really do. I've got a couple of hundred Robert Hunter tunes from all the different bands. Including, you know, mm-hmm. of course, the dad, for sure.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So your book, I mean, well, we can start at at the Fillmore, at Bill Graham's Fillmore. I mean, I used to go there. I saw the Dead there and the Airplane. I saw Jimi Hendrix in 66 or 67. It was his first, he was up in Seattle. He came down to San Francisco. It was his first gig in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I didn't know who I was really going to see. But, you know, the guy knocked my socks off, of course. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
What a deal. And then Winterland and all the great scenes happening there. And I followed the Dead when they were the Warlocks. They used to play up in Rionito, the Warlocks, before they became the Dead. And I remember them, and I go, holy geez, that was the Grateful Dead I saw before they changed their name.
There you go. Yeah.
So I've just kind of, you know, when the Dead came out with their first album, we were just, everybody was so excited because it was a local band that had actually, you know, broken through and gotten the, you know, it's the Airplane and the Dead, you know. And so it was a really exciting time. And the bands were awesome, and they've been awesome for decades in the San Francisco Bay Area. So
I like to tell people I'm glad I was born when I was born, because I think that my generation got to hear probably the greatest music of you know, all time.
Yeah, absolutely. I really think so. Yes, absolutely. And that's really where my collection, it's folk rock and blues. I'm really big on the Chess Records and the Chicago blues scene. But and in the San Francisco music scene, I just love it. And I pretty much have the music anyway covered on the thing.
Yeah.
So we can just start from there and just work our way up through the thing. There was, you know, the Carousel and the Family Dog and stuff like that. Do you have any connection with the Family Dog?
Well, not really. I was not a resident of the San Francisco Bay Area until 1975.
Okay.
Although I visited the Bay Area in 69. Mm-hmm. We stayed with a band called Mount Rushmore, which was doing a lot of opening spots at the Fillmore, West, and the Family Dog. And then I visited the Bay Area in 71 and 73, and then finally moved here in 75. So that era had pretty much passed. I did become good friends with Chet Helms, who was the person behind the Family Dog.
Yeah.
Chet and I held the only distinction of being the two people that had managed Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Yeah.
Of course, Chet managed the original group and introduced Janis Joplin to the band. And then Big Janis left the band in 1970. Big Brother broke up in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And then 15 years later, in 1987, the original four guys, Sam Andrew, Peter Albin, Dave Getz, and James Gurley, decided to reunite, and they asked me if I would manage their business at that point, which
Wonderful.
Was a great honor. So
Absolutely. Now, I was raised in Marin County, so I was friends with Dave Getz down in Marin in the late 60s and stuff, and Janis had just left Big Brother, and boy, they were pretty upset. And I just thought most of the stuff, I looked up some of the stuff that she wrote. She wrote some great stuff with Big Brother and the Holding Company, and after she went on her own thing, it was mostly covers and stuff like that. So I think she was in a real creative time with Big Brother and the Holding Company. And geez, they're cheap.
I think that was the highlight of her career. She got pulled away by Albert Grossman, who said, you know, you don't need this band, you can be a star on your own. And so she decided to go in that direction, and that's rock and roll.
And that's rock and roll, yeah. But I mean, you're in a band called Big Brother and Holding Company. You have a number one national album. It was number one, Cheap Thrills. I go, you can't do much, Steve. You can't do much better than that, I'll tell you.
For sure.
But yeah, no, people were talking in her ear, you know, go solo and stuff. And anyway, those things happen. People make decisions. Yeah.
Bottom line, it's a business, and It's one of the big things that Bill Graham taught me. He said, and this was in the late 80s, I remember him saying to me, Steve, you know, I've been in this business for many years, and when I started in the 60s, it was the music business, and the operative word was music back then. And if you were well rehearsed and you had some good chops, you know, as a band, you probably could make a living. He said, now, and again, this was the late 80s, he said, now music business is the important word. Mm-hmm. He said, I don't care if you're good or not. If you've got your business trip together, you can probably make a living. And then he said, turn on MTV. And again, this was the late 80s. Turn on MTV. There's a lot of crap on there.
Mm-hmm.
But they have their business trip together, so they're able to succeed. So both of those words are certainly important in, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the music business.
Yeah, the music does change, and the 80s did change music quite a bit. It really did. It went more, I don't know what you would call it, the kind of music that it was. I think it was more business-oriented, like you said.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
The venues are there to make money, and musicians, that's how they make their living. So
absolutely.
The more organized your business piece is, I don't care how good your music is, mm-hmm. if you don't have the business trip together, you're probably not going to succeed.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So let's go over some of the people here that you've worked with over the decades. The Dinosaurs, the New Riders of the Purple Sage, Country Joe McDonald, Merle Sanders, Nick Gravanites, Barry the Fish Melton Band, Big Brother and the Holding Company, the Sun Kings, Zero with Steve Kimmock, the Unauthorized Rolling Stones, Ray Manzarek. Is that Ray Manzarek from The Doors?
Yeah, Manzarek.
Manzarek. He's the keyboard from The Doors, yeah.
Keyboard player from The Doors, yes. And I worked with Ray in the last couple of years of Ray's life. I have been working with an amazing slide guitar player, Roy Rogers.
Yes, yes.
Not to be confused with the cowboy.
No, exactly, yeah.
And I was booking Roy Rogers and the Delta Rhythm Kings. And then a couple of years ago, Roy Rogers and Ray Manzarek hooked up and decided they would form the Manzarek Rogers Band.
Oh, I see.
So I started doing bookings for them. And Ray was an amazing individual. He was extremely intelligent, mm-hmm. spoke multiple languages, very well spoken, good sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I remember spending a couple of different visits at his house. He had a place outside of the town of Napa in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And just a wonderful guy and a real loss when he passed.
Yes, absolutely. He was an incredible keyboard player. I mean, this guy was...
He was indeed.
He kind of really carried the Doors with his keyboard. Yeah, he really, really did.
He did. He did, for sure.
Yeah. And then, let's see, Country Joe McDonald. He went on for a while after Country Joe and the Fish.
Yeah, and Country Joe was actually one of my first experiences in the music business. Mm-hmm. 1970, I believe it was, I was living in Washington, D.C., going to American University. I was a big-time anti-war activist. I was very much against the Vietnam War. I had been mm-hmm. in the first draft lottery, and I was drafted 37, so I thought they were going to call me up, and I did a couple of things to make sure that they didn't draft me.
Good.
But anyway, I became a member of what was called the National Peace Action Coalition,
mm-hmm.
which was the anti-Vietnam movement in Washington, D.C., and we put on an event called the Moratorium on the Capitol steps, the same Capitol steps that were raided this past January.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had probably about 100,000 people there, and Rennie Davis and Dick Gregory and a whole bunch of mm-hmm. speakers and Joan Baez and Paula Guthrie and many
wow.
entertainers as well.
Wow.
And my job was to pick up Joe McDonald and his manager, Bill Belmont, at their hotel, bring them to the Capitol, and then take them back to their hotel after the event was over. So I called up Bill Belmont and I said, Joe is supposed to play at 1 o'clock and I'm going to be at your hotel at 11:30. There's a lot of traffic in the city, so we need to, you know, make sure that you guys are downstairs and ready to roll at 11:30. So I showed up at 11:30 and they weren't downstairs. So I called up to the room. They came down. And we were walking out to my car, and Joe said, let me grab my guitar out of the rental car right over here, and, you know, and then we'll be off and running. So he goes over to his rental car, and he can't get the trunk open. So Joe starts to say, well, I can't play without my guitar. So I said, well, get into your car, follow me down the road. There's a Hertz rental car down there, and they'll open our trunk. We go down to the Hertz rental car. They can't open the trunk. They say, go back to the airport where you originally rented it and see if they can open it. They did. We got the trunk open. Got the guitar. They got into my car. We left the rental car where it was, and we went off to the Capitol. So that was my first exposure to a, you know, to a well-known musician, and you know, it kind of went on from there.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, and then I see Commander Cody. You managed Commander Cody, right?
Well, I didn't manage. I did bookings for Commander Cody and, you know, in his band for maybe 8 or 10 years in this century. Mm-hmm. And, of course, his real name is George Frain. And George is just a character. I don't really know how to describe him. But he was... He liked the party, and his music really spread that energy to his audience and kind of inspired people to be as crazy as he was.
Okay, yeah. No, I've got some Commander Cody. Yeah, he's a wild guy.
yeah.
Absolutely. And then I interviewed Shayna Morrison a couple of years ago. She's what a sweetheart. She's really a sweetheart.
You know, Shayna is one of those people that she's got all of the qualities that any performer could ever hope to have to, you know, to be successful. She's an amazingly wonderful singer. She's a delightful person. Mm-hmm. She's as beautiful as she can be.
Yes.
She surrounds herself with great talent. So she's the whole package. And of course she's got good genes too. Her father Sir Van Morrison.
Yeah, Sir Van Morrison. That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
He was knighted. Yeah.
I interviewed her, and then she got me. She was playing in the area. The River Theater. She played at the River Theater and caught me two tickets after my interview with her, and then I got to introduce her on stage and stuff. So she was a real sweetheart. And she said one thing to me. She said that she's like her dad's. She felt that her voice was an instrument, which is very interesting, because I never thought that a voice is really an instrument, but it is, if you think about it, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
So she's a real sweetheart. She gave me all her albums and everything, and I play her regularly. She's really, really cool. Yeah, she's a very cool gal.
And, very wonderful, yes.
Now, Brian Auger, where is Brian Auger from? I've heard the name.
He had a group called the Oblivion Express, and then he had a group called Trinity.
Okay.
I didn't work with him for that long of a time, maybe a year or so. Mm-hmm. And I actually never met Brian, but, you know, I did bookings for him at different places around the country.
Yeah. All right. And what is your connection with Canned Heat? I love the Canned Heat. With the
Canned
Bear.
Canned Heat, I worked with their manager and booked a number of shows for them over the years. I didn't have a close and personal relationship with them. I saw them at Woodstock.
Yeah.
But, and then they played another event in the late 90s in San Francisco. It wasn't the original band, but it was some of the original guys.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I saw him when Harvey Mandel joined the group. I think it was somewhere in 2000. I went to a gig where they brought in Harvey Mandel to do the Canned Heat. He's a friend of mine. He's a friend of mine. Yeah.
Yep.
So anyway, I'm in real estate, and so he called me, and he wanted to look at a piece of property, and I said, well, what's your name? And he says, well, I'm Harvey Mandel. And I said, you must get really joked a lot with a name like that. And he says, no, nobody jokes at all with me about it because I am Harvey Mandel. I go, Jesus, I'm talking to Harvey Mandel on the phone. And I got to know him, show him some property and smoke with him and stuff. And I've interviewed him like three times now. We became friends and stuff, and he's much better now. Yeah. He's gotten through all his health issues, and he's doing pretty good.
He had a very rough period in his life for sure, so I'm glad to see that he's gotten through that, and he makes magic with his music.
He's probably one of the top top American guitar players, and I would really think he's up there in at least the top 10, or maybe the top 5 or something like that.
Absolutely,
it's awesome. And this stuff, the Chicago Blues reunion, they've really knocked it out of the park. I love that group, the Chicago Blues reunion with Nick Ravenitis.
With Nick Ravenitis and Barry Goldberg,
and Harvey Mandel, and I interviewed Barry a couple of times. He's a sweet man. He really is. Some of these people, you know, that are famous and stuff, they go, "Well, I'm famous," and some people are just famous and just as easy and down home and kind, you know. And Barry Goldberg's unbelievable. He really is. He's had a wonderful career. Yeah. Now he's with the Rides. Steven Stills groups, The Rides,
right. So I've worked with Nick Ravenitis since the early 1980s as well.
Nick is unbelievable. He really is. Yeah, he's so talented. I love that the My Labor album, that one with. It's such a treat because you get Mike Bloomfield and Nick Ravenitis in that album, My Labor. That's going to go down as a classic if it already hasn't. I know it didn't do that well when it came out, but people should pick that album up. I've got it. It's unbelievable because there's so few of Mike Bloomfield. I mean, it was such a tragic event. He was right up there with Eric Clapton, as far as I'm concerned, and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band and all that. And it was just a real tragedy to have him go. So there was very few albums. That he's on Highway 61 Revisited, and he knocked it out of the park on that one.
Yeah.
And he really
Mike was the first act that I ever worked with.
Oh, okay. Wow, all right.
In 1980, I broke up with my girlfriend, and I moved into a house with a gentleman by the name of Steve Mallory. And Steve was the bass player in a band called Chicago Blues Power.
Okay.
Chicago Blues Power was Mike Bloomfield's backup band.
Oh, wow.
And Mike was not in the best of shape. He had certainly substance abuse problems. I remember the New Year's Eve of the last New Year's Eve of Mike's life. I spent with him at his home in Mill Valley. I remember very clearly walking into his house, walking down the hallway to the living room where he was, and I looked on the wall, and there were Super Session gold records.
Oh, right, Super Session,
And it was very tilted. And I thought to myself, you know, most of the people in this world would kill to have a gold record, and he didn't even have the respect to, you know, have it displayed properly. And I don't know why I remember that, but it just kind of bugged me. And then I walked into the living room and hung out with Mike, and he was kind of slumped over the chair, and he wasn't in great shape. Not long after that, Chicago Blues Power did a show in Sausalito, and Mike was going to play, but he said, "I want to play piano. I don't want to play guitar tonight." So we set up a little electric piano, and the band was there on stage. The band was Ron Bukovich, who played guitar. His credits include Van Morrison and Junior Wells. Ben King Perkoff, who had played with Mary Wells, Big Mama May Courtney.
Oh, Mary Wells, she's big.
Hart McNee was on baritone sax. He played with Boz Scaggs and Steve Miller. The drummer was John Chambers, who played with We Five and John Coltrane.
Wow.
And they had a great percussionist named Lonnie Showtime Walter, who played with Aretha and Jackie Wilson.
Yeah.
And their lead singer was Applejack Waltrip. Who sung with Elvin Bishop and Sam Lay.
Jeez.
So the band was all on stage in Sausalito, and Bloomfield wasn't there. wasn't unusual for him to be late. Finally, he walked into the room, and he kind of slowly walked towards the stage, and the band's all up on stage, and he walks over to center stage and sits down on the keyboard, lays his head down on the keyboard, and passes out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's what I said.
So, oh, boy.
So we woke him up and helped him up the stairs, and I called a cab. There were no Ubers at that time. This was, 1980.
Yeah.
And they took him back to his, to his Mill Valley home. And then, a few months later, he was found OD'd in his car, bent over the steering wheel on 19th Avenue in San Francisco.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
So I thought, well, there's yeah, so there goes my career, because now I don't have a, I have a band, but I can't say, it's Michael Bloomfield's band. So,
right.
That was that. And then a day or so after Bloomfield passed away, Boz Scaggs called up the leader of Chicago Blues Power. Now, at that time, Boz was one of the biggest figures in the world. His Silk Degree album had gone gold a couple of years earlier. Mm-hmm. He had another album out at that time to follow up with it, and he was just huge. So Boz said to the leader of Chicago Blues Power that he would like to come down to the Saloon, which is this little 80-seat venue in North Beach, San Francisco. Boz was asking, "Can I come down to the Saloon and sit in with Chicago Blues Power to pay my respects to my hero, Michael Bloomfield?"
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ron Bukovic said, "Yes, you can come down." thrilling.
Yes.
So Bob said, "Okay, well, I'll be there Saturday night. I have only one request." And Ron said, "What is that?" Bob said, "You can never call me Boz Scaggs, because my agent and my manager and my record label would kill me playing in this little room for, a $5 cover charge. So you have to refer to me as Dallas Slim."
No.
We said, okay, and Boz is an old Texas boy, so, his name, I guess at some point, may have been Dallas Slim. But anyway, he showed up, and everybody knew who he was, but we never called him Boz. We always referred to him as Dallas Slim. And he was just a great guy. I got to hang out with him a good bit. And over the next couple of months, Boz came down 4, 5, 6 times to the Saloon and sat in.
Hmm.
So I knew at that time, because you remember Herb Kane, the columnist from the Chronicle?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I knew that Herb was a huge fan of Boz Scaggs. So every couple of weekends, Boz would come down to the Saloon, and every Monday morning I'd give Herb Kane a call and tell him, "Your boy was down at the Saloon again," and he said, "Every time he comes down, give me a different angle, and I'll write it up." And of course, Herb Kane was the reason that many people bought the Chronicle, and and it was probably the first thing that many people went to when they had the Chronicle.
They did.
Again,
they did.
This was way before the internet.
Yes, yes. I used to always look when I did the Chronicle. I'd always look and see what Herb Kane had to say. He was
right.
He had his hand on the pulse of San Francisco. He really did.
He did. And every Monday I would call him, and then the day after, Tuesday morning, I'd open the Chronicle, and there'd be two or three sentences about Boz Scaggs sitting in the Chicago Blues Tower at the Saloon. So now I could call any venue in the greater Bay Area, because the Chronicle was read in Lafayette as well as in Marin and the South Bay and everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd call up these venues and I'd say, "Chicago Blues Power, you want them at your club?" And they'd say, "Of course," thinking that maybe Boz would come along.
Yes.
He never did, but I was able to get Chicago Blues Power so busy. I remember them telling me at one point, "Slow down, Steve, we've got 15 gigs that month."
Wow.
This month, that's good. Month for now. It was so easy to book them. I had club owners that would take my call. I had club bookers that would return my messages because they were thinking I'm going to get Boz in my club. Never happened, but I was able to expand my territory with Chicago Blues Power, and then realized, well, I've got all these different venues now, but I only have one band.
Yeah.
So I started to recruit other bands and built a booking agency, and it kind of went on from there.
Wonderful. That's great. Yeah. Well, you're known as one of the premier booking agents in the San Francisco music scene, and you know your stuff. You really do. Now, we got Kim Wilson's Blues All-Stars.
Uh-huh.
What's your connection with them?
I worked for, this is in this century, I worked with a friend of mine, Stephen Gordon. He had an agency called Savoy Music. And that was one of the bands that Steve had recruited, and so I just did bookings for Kim, amazing harmonica player. I don't think I've ever met him, but so I was just strictly a booking agent, and I worked mm-hmm. most of that paperwork and communication through the booking agency itself.
So that was more in 2000, or?
Maybe it was 2010.
So more recent band then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. But he was, of course, with the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he was. Oh, the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Oh,
yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're awesome. They are really an awesome group. Yeah, they're a big name. So anyway, you got Roy Rogers and the Delta Rhythm Kings. I love Roy Rogers.
Roy is one of a kind. I mean, nobody plays his style of guitar, and he more recently has been playing, of course, other than the COVID year we've just gone through, but he's been playing with Carlos Reyes.
Wow.
Who is this amazing electric violin, electric harp player.
Oh, okay.
And they've been making some magical music together as well. But Roy is, I overuse the word, but Roy is unique.
Yeah, he's very talented. He started with the Charlatans. He was in the Charlatans and then John Lee Hooker band, blues band.
I don't remember him in the Charlatans, but he did play guitar for Hooker, yeah.
Yeah, no, I looked him up. Yeah, he was in the Charlatans before he went solo. Yeah, yeah. The Charlatans, this going back to the mid-60s. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't stay together for too long, yeah. But I interviewed Roy, and he's a sweet man. He really is. He gave me a very good interview. Very
good
positive interview. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So Linda Imperial Band. I've heard of Linda Imperial.
Mm-hmm.
What's her connection? What band was she in? And she went solo, I guess.
Linda Imperial is married to David Freiberg. David Freiberg was, of course, in the original Quicksilver Messenger Service, and he was in Jefferson Starship.
Oh, okay. Yeah, David Freiberg. So Quicksilver, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Starship,
Yeah, so Linda decided to form her own band, and they asked me to be their booking agent.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, that's going way back there, with the Starship and the Quicksilver Messenger Service. Absolutely. And then
one of the reasons why my life has been so incredible is when I was a teenager growing up in Baltimore, Maryland, I never quite felt that I fit in, and I didn't know why, but I just felt weird. And part of it might have been that my dad passed away when I was 16. Part of it might have been that I started smoking pot and taking acid when I was 17 or 18.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very confused with just something didn't seem right, but I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I got very much into music. I got very much into the Dead and the Airplane and Quicksilver and Big Brother and Country Joe and those type of acts.
Yes.
And I found great strength in that because here they were singing lyrics that I could relate to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I also knew that it wasn't just me, that it was people all over the country that were feeling the same thing and also thought like I thought.
Yes, absolutely.
And it wasn't until I moved to California that I realized that a lot of those people are here in the Bay Area. There were not that many of those people where I was growing up. So the fact that these were my heroes as a teenager that really helped to keep me together and to keep me sane, and then to grow up and be an adult and to be able to work with so many of these people that were my heroes as an adult and help them with their careers, I'm truly blessed.
Yeah, I think the music was all connected with the civil rights movement too, and all the marching we did, and all that.
Yeah.
And I think we moved civil rights another peg up. You know, it still needs to be worked on, even now, unfortunately. But we're getting there. We're getting there with the civil rights for all, and Black Lives Matter. Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. And the '50s were the most powerful generation in modern times as far as beginning the changes in civil rights, in
anti-war,
in racial equality, in peace over war,
exactly,
in women's rights,
exactly,
in so many things, in the ecology and the environment, so many areas that are still issues today, but a lot of them had their foundations in the 60s.
Well, Steve, I fell down the same rabbit hole when I was a young man. I just love this music, and And we have a very unique generation that said, look at everybody's, we're on the same planet, let's all treat each other the same, you know, let's do that. We had some really great ideas, and I'm very proud of our generation, Steve, absolutely.
Likewise.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So let's see, who else here? We got the Otis Redding legacy. What's that all about?
A couple of years ago, I established a friendship with a musician that wanted to start an Otis Redding band. And of course, Otis's connection with the Bay Area is well founded. He was performing in San Francisco many years back. This was right before he passed away, and he was staying what I've been told was Bill Graham's houseboat in Sausalito.
Wow!
And this is where he wrote "Sitting on the Dock of the Bay."
See, that is a beautiful album. I was just going to say that is an awesome album. Yeah.
Yeah. So McKinley Moore is the. Is the person who does Otis, and he does a very, very good job of playing all of Otis's hits. Has a great horn section, it's just wonderful that I've never heard anybody do Otis at all.
Wonderful.
And McKinley Moore certainly does him with great respect, and he's got it for sure.
Now, Otis Redding, he was very unique. He really was. He was very special. And
he was only known for, I think, about 5 years.
Huh.
You know, during the 60s, and then he passed away in that plane crash, I believe, in 67.
Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Oh, because I know all of it. I remember him and saying that he passed away, but I couldn't remember. But it was, and his life was taken at a very young age, He was really ready for it. He already broke out and was a big star by the time he'd passed away with a Dock of the Bay.
So were Janis and Jimmy and Jim.
I know.
They all died when they were 27.
27. Oh, were Otis too at 27?
Otis, I can't remember how old he was, but Janis and Jimmy and Jim Morrison were all 27.
Yeah, all of them, yeah. There's something about it, yeah. What a deal. So what's the San Francisco airship? Is that connected with the airplane at all, or?
Yes and no. San Francisco airship was formed in 2016.
Uh-huh.
Chris Lockheed on drums, Mark Levine on bass, Jeff Kaplan on guitar, JoJo Razor on vocals, and the original Marty Ballin character was Jolie Valente, Dino Valente's son.
Oh, yeah, okay. Dino Valente, yeah.
And they're very respectfully and very effectively covering Jefferson Airplane and some Jefferson Starship.
Wonderful.
They rolled out in the 2017, which was the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love. And they performed at the Young Museum in Golden Gate Park to celebrate the opening of the Summer of Love exhibit there.
Okay, cool.
They also performed that year at the Earth Day Festival in front of City Hall and Civic Center Plaza in San Francisco. And then in June of 2017, they had a Summer of Love Day at AT&T Park. And before the Giants game that day, San Francisco Airship set up on the roof of the dugout, and they played about a 30-minute set.
Wonderful. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool. So the music continues, absolutely. The music
scene. It does, and again, it's so exciting for me because the Airplane were really my favorite band of all of the old San Francisco bands. And not only be the road manager for Jefferson Starship for 4 years with Paul Kantner.
Oh, you were.
Jack Cassidy and Papa John Creech. I also got to work with San Francisco Airship and got to hear a lot of my favorite music.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I know Pete. I interviewed Pete Sears. He gave me an awesome interview. He's some really great artists in the Starship. Yeah. So what is the blues? The Blues Mothers is there's some of these groups, I guess, that are later.
The Blues Mothers was in the past couple of years, and they are a Blues Brothers tribute.
Oh, cool!
They dress in full costume. They've got all of the steps that you saw in the Blues Brothers movie, and they're doing all the Blues Brothers tunes. They even have an Aretha Franklin character who does Think, which was in the original Blues Brothers movie. But
yes.
This is about as fun a band as I've ever worked with. They're extremely talented. They're as tight as they can be, horn section as well, they just make me smile.
That sounds like a lot of fun. That
totally totally fun band.
Yeah, yeah. So it's good music and a little comedy.
Exactly, and they do mix that in. They do mix in some of the shticks that were in the movie that they duplicate.
Yeah. So let's see, the next group, Lunafish. What's your connection with Lunafish?
Lunafish is a terrific cover band. They're playing, I call it, classic rock's greatest hits. Huh. And that's basically what they're doing. They have a huge set list, mainly songs from the 60s and 70s, although they do touch on some other decades. Very tight, very polished, and... if you like to sing along, you'll be singing the entire night when you go to a Lunafish fest.
Sounds cool. And then what's the group, The Refugees? Is that some Tom Petty thing or what?
That is a wonderful Tom Petty tribute band out of the East Bay. And you listen to a Tom Petty record, you listen to these guys. I can't tell the difference.
Whoa, all right.
Yes, very good. Very good.
Very cool. And it's even more important now after we've lost such a great artist as Tom Petty.
No question.
That was a real shocker because he was the young kid in the Wilburys. He was the young
traveling Wilburys.
Yeah, he was the young guy.
Only the good die young, huh?
I guess so. Yes.
Yeah.
So what's the group, the Chicago the Tribute? Is that a tribute band for the group Chicago? Or
I thought you might figure that out. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Chicago is one of those bands that I think they had more hit records pretty much than anybody, maybe other than the Beatles. And when I found that out, it was like kind of surprising, but they just have hit after hit after hit. Chicago the Tribute, 8-piece band, 3 horns, and again, you think you're listening to the record. These guys have it down, lots of soul, lots of talent, and an amazing catalog of music. I mean, hit after hit after hit.
What a deal. So I met Bill Chaplin. He was in Chicago, and I met him when he was in the Sons of Chaplin. And I was friends with Terry Haggerty. I used to go out with his sister, Linda Haggerty. And Terry is awesome. I've had him on KOWS radio here. And but Bill went to, they picked him up. Chicago picked him up. And I guess that was the end of the Sons of Chaplin.
Well, and then the Sons reformed after that. So.
Oh, cool. That's great.
It goes in and out. But Terry, great guy. I know him well. And Bill Chaplin, I mean, what a voice.
Yeah, Bill is quite the songwriter as well. Yeah. So what's your connection with the New Riders of the Purple Sage? I love those guys.
Well, I was friends with Marmaduke, John Dawson.
Okay.
And he put that band together, I'm saying, somewhere in maybe like the mid-80s. And I did a bunch of bookings for them. I remember hanging out a bunch of times in the canyon just near Larkspur, California.
Larkspur Canyon.
John was a huge baseball fan, so we watched a bunch of Giants games together.
Yeah. Mr. Marmaduke, yeah. No, I was raised in the Larkspur Canyon, in Larkspur.
Yeah.
That's Madrone Canyon, right. Yeah. And my dad owned a home there, and I lived most of my youth there. And it's a very special little place, yeah. But I met Marmaduke, kind of inadvertently. I mean, I was just this gullible, you know, stoner head at 22, you know, with long hair. And we had this band. We had a softball team. And we were a bunch of heads that liked to play baseball, drink beer, and smoke pot. And somebody had some connections. And the music business, we played the Trident, and we played the group Clover. I don't know if you remember the group Clover.
I remember them well.
Yeah, yeah. And but somebody had connections with the Dead, and we played the Dead a couple of times. And one of my fondest memories is I used to pitch for this team, and we beat them every time we did that. And then I used to hang out down where they used to play. There was a baseball a diamond behind the town of Fairfax there, and they used to meet there, I think, on Sundays and play ball. So I went down there, and they had me pitch for them. I got to pitch for them. And one of my fondest memories is waiting in bat with Jerry Garcia and pulling out a pipe load of Nepalese hash and stoking it up, getting it like really cold up, and then handing it to Jerry. And I think smoke came out of his ears. and then I was going out with one of the girls at the Dead House just down the road in Ross, in the town of Ross there, that shady grove down there. And I met Marmaduke. I smoked it with Marmaduke while I was waiting for one of the Dead girls to come on downstairs so I could take her out and stuff. So I got to rub shoulders with some people. And it's just, you know, a gullible 22-year-old head that just lucked out being at the right place at the right time. But I love what David Nelson is doing to the new Riders of the Purple Sage.
Yeah.
I really do. You know, a lot of this is the wonderfulness of the Grateful Dead was the transference of music with the Robert Hunter lyrics. And, of course, Jerry did a wonderful job. But I think so David Nelson has been working with Robert Hunter while he was still alive, and put out some wonderful albums that were co-written by David Nelson and Robert Hunter. And the transference of that music is just phenomenal. Just phenomenal, what David Nelson did. He really came into himself. And
he really did. And he's had his health challenges, too. But he's just done such a wonderful thing of keeping that music of that era alive.
Absolutely. I know he's over 80 now. I think he's over 80. It's just phenomenal. We saw him down at the Mystic. We saw him. And it's just incredible, the energy he's got at 80 years old. He's like influence to everybody of elderly age, you know.
Absolutely.
To keep on keeping on, yeah. But there's some incredible albums, yeah, yeah. So what's your connection here with Merle Sanders? I think we talked about him a little bit.
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned earlier, I was managing the band Dinosaurs in the early 80s. And in 85, Hunter left the band, and Merle, who had sat in a few times previous to that, decided he would become the fifth member of Dinosaurs, playing his B3 organ.
Wow.
And Merle and I became very good friends. I was the promotions director for his record label, Sumertone Records. Spent a lot of time at his house in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
I also was the booking agent and the road manager for some of the bands that he toured with, including the Rainforest Band. Merle put out an album early 90s called Blues from the Rainforest with him and Jerry Garcia.
Oh, yeah. They did some albums,
So I was the road manager for the Rainforest Band. He also created a band called Gratefully Yours, which was a Grateful Dead tribute band featuring Steve Kimmock, amongst others.
Wow.
And was also the road manager for that band.
He was incredible. Steve Kimmock's incredible.
Steve is incredible, for sure. And in fact, I was at a Thunder and Lightning show with John Cipollina and Nick Rabinitis in 1984 at the Keystone Berkeley. And this guy walks up to me and hands me a cassette, and he says, "This is my new band. I need a booking agent. Can you help me out?" And it was Greg Anton, the drummer and founder of Zero.
Wow. And, Greg Anton, the drummer, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's when I started to work with Zero.
Wonderful.
But Merle Saunders, in his birthday, it was Valentine's Day, and every year they would hold a party for him, typically at the Great American Music Hall, celebrating his birthday. And on one particular year, he had a stroke in the early 2000s.
Who did?
And
Greg did?
Merle Saunders.
Oh, Merle. Yeah, Merle. Okay.
He had a stroke in the early 2000s, and we had a party for him at the Great American Music Hall. And I remember he asked me to come and sit at his table, and which I was honored to do because I was sitting between Merle Saunders, Wavy Gravy, Bonnie Raitt, Dr. Larry Brilliant, and Max Gale.
Jesus.
Yeah, really. And so the band was playing, and Merle had a difficult time talking and moved very slowly, but his spirit was still great and strong.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point he said, "Steve, I want to go up on the stage and play." And I was kind of like, "You don't want to do that." But he said, "No, I want to do that." So he was sitting, as you face the stage, on the far right against the wall.
Huh.
And I got him up, and I helped him walk all the way to the back of the room, around the back, to the other side of the stage, and helped him up on the stage. And he sat there, and I had my video camera with me, and he played his last performance. He just one song, but that was his last performance ever.
Wow.
In front of so many of the people that he loved.
Yes. That's a wonderful venue.
Very special. Yeah. Did you know that Merle Saunders was in a band in high school with a guy by the name of Johnny Mathis?
No. Johnny Mathis. Oh my God.
Yeah, the real Johnny Mathis. Oh. And also in that band was Lionel Hampton. So.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, and there's a picture of that band in my book. So.
Whoa, wonderful. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, Steve Kimmock, he gave me an interview, gave me a really, really good interview. He was coming up to the North Bay and playing at the Raven in Healdsburg. And
uh-huh.
So I connected with him and, let him know all the people that I'd interviewed. And so he acquiesced to an interview, gave me a fantastic interview. He's such a nice guy, and he's so funny. He says some really funny stuff. And,
he does. Yeah.
And
I got to tour with him a couple of times.
What
a character and what a talent.
And what a talent. And he just treated me so nicely. He gave me a really nice interview. I played some of his music and advertised to go to the Raven. And he gave me and my partner, Linda, some comp tickets, and we went, and I got a picture of him, and it's on my wall.
Cool.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, he was a very cool guy. He really was, and with really no ego, just really nice gentleman, So some of these artists are just unbelievably nice. They really, really are, yeah.
Most of the artists I've worked with are unbelievably nice and have little, if any, ego.
Yeah.
A couple not so, but... The vast majority of musicians I've worked with have been ladies and gentlemen, and didn't put on any airs because they were famous and I was not. So.
There we go.
The best example of that was probably John Cipollina, because he was so well known and so loved.
Yeah.
And yet he was one of the most humble people I ever met.
Wow.
He was one of those kind of guys who could play a 3-hour show, and right after the show, he wouldn't go backstage. He'd come off the stage and stand there and talk to the fans, and he wouldn't leave until the fans were finished talking to him.
Wow.
And when he signed an autograph, he'd always ask the person's name, and he would sign it to that person. I mean,
That's pretty cool.
John, to me, was the archetypal rock and roller. He had the look, he had the style, he had the sound, and he had just the most amazing, humorous, intelligent personality probably
cool.
that I've ever known.
Cool. Yeah, he was, people that don't know, was the lead guitar player for Quicksilver Messenger Service.
Right.
And they were unbelievable. And the guy could really bend a guitar. He was a phenomenal guitar player. And I still see a lot of posts about him on Facebook and stuff, and just how nice and how friendly he was. You could see. And that he was really well-loved. And... Now, he was in the Dinosaurs, too, right?
He was the original guitar player in Dinosaurs with Barry Melton,
So what's your connection? Go ahead.
No, finish your question.
What was your connection with Mickey Hart?
With Mickey Hart, I was working with Barry Melton and the Dinosaurs, and he also had a little side band called Fish and Chip with Melton and Chipolina.
Oh.
And Barry was very good friends with Mickey Hart. And at one point, Barry said to me, my friend Mickey needs somebody to run his business, to take care of, you know, his finances and his payroll and his this and his that. And so I met with Mickey, and I worked for Mickey Hart from 1984 to 1988. And every penny that came into Mickey and every penny that went out from Mickey came across my desk. And I did a lot of other little things. I worked on various projects with Mickey. He was writing a book at the time. He was working on an album at the time. Mm-hmm. I think he was working on a score for a movie at the time.
Wow.
I worked with him. My favorite part of working with Mickey was whenever there'd be a local Bay Area Grateful Dead show, Mickey would put me in charge of his guest list. So I would drop off tickets here, and I would mail tickets there, and I'd leave tickets at the box office, this one and that one. Mm-hmm. And I remember a New Year's Eve show at the Oakland Coliseum, and I'm backstage, and I've still got 20 Grateful Dead New Year's Eve tickets in my hand. And so I walked into the dressing room. I said, Mickey, is there anything you want me to do with this? He says, I don't care. Do whatever you want. So I went outside into the parking lot, and I found the saddest-looking, homeless-looking deadheads I could find. And I said, you need a miracle? and I gave away those 20 tickets.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
One of my most fun times ever. Yeah.
Wonderful. You know, he's what a talent, that guy, isn't he? Did, after he left the Dead, the Mickey Hart Band did a lot of co-writing with Robert Hunter. They made some very beautiful music. And I think he got a Grammy. He got a Grammy for... they're doing this world music. It's just incredible what he does.
In fact, I helped to helped him with a concert he put on called World Music in Schools.
Huh.
His whole idea was to spread music from different cultures to other cultures in the schools, and that way you could learn more about that culture through their music.
Wonderful. So we did
this benefit concert at the Petaluma Vets Hall. And it included Olatunji and his Drums of Passion. And that was like, I think, an 8 or 10 piece dance troupe and percussion troupe. And then playing guitar was a fellow by the name of Carlos Santana and another guy by the name of Jerry Garcia.
Oh, no kidding.
yeah.
That's incredible.
That was pretty amazing. But Mickey is one of the most creative, talented people that I've ever known. He just had ideas coming out of all sides of him, and you know, from the moment he woke up to the moment he went to sleep, he was interested in creating things. So great respect for that guy.
Yeah, he made some beautiful music with the Dead and all his solo albums as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed.
Yeah. So let's just hear. It's looks like the hour is up here. We've had a really good talk, and time flies when you're having a good time.
Really, absolutely.
Yeah, so let's see with the book here. Let's direct people towards your book, your e-book, www.stevekeiser, that's KEYSER.com. And it's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderful read. It starts with your family and your youth and what led you to love this beautiful music, that like we all do, or many of us do. And I think it's just a fabulous book, absolutely. And I just encourage anybody and everybody to check that out. So, Steve, thank you so much.
And again, I just want to mention real quickly, it is a free book. I wasn't interested in writing the book to make money. I wanted to just share my experience with people. So you can go to that website and either read it on the website, or you can click on it and download it onto your computer and then, you know, have that to read at your leisure.
Wonderful. Yeah, I've got it on my computer, and I'm looking it over, and it's how many pages? Do you know how many pages it is? It's a lot of pages.
It's 100 and some. Hang on a second.
Yeah, I bet.
It is. I got 223 pages.
Yeah.
I don't know if this word. I think it's about 150 pages.
What a deal.
There's over 140 photographs. So it's not 140 pages of just text. There's a lot of photographs to embellish the text.
Wonderful, wonderful. I encourage everybody to check it out. And Steve, thank you so much for the awesome interview. I really look forward to it. Everybody here at KOWS Radio is really excited about you coming on. So we really appreciate it. Absolutely.
Jerry, thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
Okay, awesome. Thanks for the awesome interview, Steve.
Enjoy your weekend.
Okay, you too as well. Thank you.